Okay, so this was my 2 o'clock in the morning share for Shavuos. I don't even remember the last time. When did we learn last time? Like
two months ago?
2 months ago. So at that point, we did Rosh Weiss's approach to capitalism. So we're going to try it from a totally different angle this time. So this was something new I discovered, was that apparently the early Zionists, religious and secular, had an obsession with Yovel. And the reason is basically as follows.
What's Yovel?
So 1 second, we'll get it. So basically, the early Zionist thinkers were utopian thinkers, right? Their philosophy of building the state, part of it was that they wanted to build an ideal society. So it wasn't enough for most of them just to talk about going back to Israel. They wanted to at least develop a theory. Even the ones who were way before the state actually was built, they wanted to outline the structures of the state that would make it the ideal place for a human being to live. Now, since one of the central aspects of how we live is how we relate to economics, they had economic theories. Now, many of the early Zionist thinkers were socialists, were Marxists, and this was before the state and through the state, right? Whether it be Ben Gurion or Golda Meir or whoever, many of them were Marxists or socialists of varying types. But there was a group of them who, instead of being socialists or, for that matter, pure capitalists, they decided that the Jewish state should have a unique economic model, which wasn't quite socialism or capitalism, which they found the secret for in Yovel. So what's Yovel, right? So if we just skip, I just gave you the basics, right? Number six, I'll skip around a bit because it's different sort of layout than Shavuos night. But the Torah tells us in Vayikra Chafei that v'kidashtem et shnat ha-chamishim shana u'kratem dror ba'aretz chol yoshveha, yovel hi tiyeh lochem v'shavtem ish el chuz adov ish el mishpachto teshuvu v'aretz lo t'macher l'tzmitut ki li aretz ki gerim et toshavim atem madi. So every 50th year, we have ancestral land that's divided, where when the Jews came into Israel, so they gave out the land to each family. That land is yours to do as you wish, until Yovel. But every 50th year, there's an automatic reset button, and any land that was sold, any ancestral land that is sold, goes back, right, the Jubilee year, right, Yovel goes back to the original owners. All debts are canceled just like they are in Shemitah, though this is a 2-year Shemitah, because it's the 49th and the 50th year. All Jewish slaves go free, even after they've, even if they've chosen to stay on longer, after their 6-year period, they go free. And that is, that's Yovel. Now, what I'm not going to deal with here, the truth is that it's not just the model of Israeli economics. And we'll see, this wasn't just theoretical, this actually played itself out in Israeli law, until today plays itself out in Israeli law. But this was actually also the basis for many of the...
Israeli law?
Yes, and we will get to how it is. But not Yovel as such, but... But yes, Yovel actually is integrated into Israeli law.
Oh, Shemitah, no?
Shemitah is not. No, not Israeli law. In halachic law, and there are legal implications to it, but Yovel, the Yovel theory is actually part of Israeli law in a very serious way. I can give it away now, and then I'll explain how we got there. Kakal, right? Keren Kemet Israel, right? The Jewish National Fund. So 80% of land, or... different points, different time. According to one article, it was 63%. I'm not sure when what was true. But most of the land in Israel is owned by Keren Kayemet Lisrael. When you buy land in Israel, you buy a house in Israel, you don't actually buy land. You actually rent it. It's a lease. You don't rent it. You lease it.
Going back from like the early 20th century, like all the way...
It's true now. Like right now, my house. Since then, always.
That's why my father-in-law is very happy about this house in Israel. It's actually a fee simple land. He says it's very rare.
It is very rare. So it's somewhere between 20% and 30-something% of the land is not owned by Kakal. But like my house, right? You sign it. It's not a you don't own. It's a lease.
You release it.
So that's the big controversy in Israel that's just erupted very recently. Is that theoretically yes, you have to release it. It hasn't come up yet because the country is only 70 years old, but. There were some shady deals where a few people have put advanced advanced claims on the land that is currently owned by the church, so that when their deed expires, they'll take it away from the church. Right? And it's not quite clear why, how they did that and whether it was legal. Now there's an investigation going on in Israel, because it seems to have been very, as things often are in Israel, seems to have been a little bit less than honest. But yes. But the reason that came, the reason that happened is because of Yovel. Because Yovel was so important to the early Zionists.
Interesting.
And that's what we're going to, this is why I found this fascinating. So this is a mix of like halacha, hashkafa, Zionist history, current Zion, Jewish, Israeli law. But this is the principle of Yovel, which is unique. Now, in addition to Israeli law, and this is which is what we're going to focus on now, there is... there's a fascinating book, if you like this type of stuff, by Eric Nelson, who's a professor at Harvard, called The Hebrew Republic. It's how halacha helped shape the philosophy of the American Revolution, and not like, not comparative law. This is not comparative law, like, oh, it's similar to Torah. This is... It was actually based on it, because the early American thinkers were influenced by the Christian Hebraists, and the Christian Hebraists actually write explicitly that they learned the Gemara and Rambam, and they took the Rambam and they applied it to American law, and that's how we get some of American law, and one of those things was Yovel. So the book is 3 chapters long. The second one is on land distribution and Yovel. So this is not only true of Israeli law, it's true of American law also. The obsession of Americans with democracy over monarchy is actually a Torah thing. It's actually because they took the position in the Gemara that monarchy was a bad thing. And they quote it explicitly. It's not like they're pretending. Like Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, which was probably the most important work of propaganda in the American Revolution. It was meant to rally the average American, and a good percentage of the book is an analysis of Shmuel and Shmuel's diatribe against monarchy.
Like directly or something?
Directly. It's like, this
how
is the...
That's so interesting. How
because they're all... Because they were Christian Hebraists.
Right.
Right? They were influenced by the Christian Hebraists. So
I thought they were all Puritans.
No. So most of them weren't Puritans. Thomas Paine himself was actually an atheist.
Right here,
so Paine himself was actually an atheist.
Okay.
They weren't Puritans. Many of the early ones were devout Christians of different sorts. Many of them were deists, but many of them were devout Christians of some sort or another. Puritans were influential a bit earlier in the about 100 years before that.
Yeah.
But in the actual correct
in the mid 1600s.
But the founding fathers like Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and the like were devout Christians or deists or whatever. But they were influenced by Christian thought, and a lot of the early thinkers were influenced by the Christian Hebraists.
And they read Hebrew.
They read Hebrew. Probably not the founding fathers, but the thinkers that they were based on did read Hebrew. Like Erasmus read Hebrew. Right. There was a whole school of them. But that's a topic for another time. It's a fascinating book. But here, Israeli law was very, very clearly based on Yovel. So, what I gave you here at the beginning, I'll sort of run through these English sources. But basically, the last few years, there has been a renewed debate on whether halacha, Torah, Judaism, whatever you want to say, is more capitalist or socialist. Now, Milton Friedman, I gave you a number one, claimed, right, I'll just read it to you, right? He says, two traditions were at work in Israel, an ancient one going back nearly 2,000 years of finding ways around governmental restrictions, and a modern one going back a century of belief in democratic socialism and central planning. Fortunately for Israel, the first tradition has proved far more potent than the second, right? So Milton Friedman, who was the leading philosopher of the capitalist libertarian school at Chicago, the Chicago School of Economic Thought, claimed that while the last 100 years the sort of big name Jewish thinkers were socialists, he felt that the Jewish tradition was traditionally more capitalist in the sense, and obviously capitalist and socialist can mean a lot of things, but in the sense of minimizing government control and trusting the forces of the individuals and the market. Now,
is this from that interview he has? Black, like, I don't know if you.
It's from an article called "Capitalism and the Jews."
I'll send you a good interview.
So this quote. The reason I picked this particular quote is because this quote again. This year is not just a theoretical one. This quote was invoked recently in Knesset by Ayelet Shaked, who writes that one of the reasons that she has pushed back on the trajectory of Israeli law in the last 20 years and has pushed towards a limiting legislation, which is her, is under her auspices, because as the Sarah Mishpatim, right, as the justice minister, she has to approve a law that's brought to a vote, is because she felt that Israel was too socialist and she felt Judaism was more free market, and therefore she actively was going, she felt her responsibility as a Jew, secular Jew, but running in a religious party, was to minimize government control, to bring that back back into the discourse. I gave you in two that Reb Lichtenstein, my late teacher, even though he sometimes tended a bit more left economically, he noted that the reason halacha often seems more free market or not socialist is because, the way he puts it, because halacha believes in free will. And socialism at its core, where you have to take care of everybody, is based on the philosophy at some level that they can't take care of themselves, we need to take care of them, and people couldn't pull themselves up by their bootstrings if they tried, right? Which he feels runs against sort of halacha's belief in free will. And I gave you in three, Eric Cohn summarized a lecture by Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who noted that there are many halachic principles that seem to push towards the more capitalist approach, respect for property rights, biblical appreciation of productive labor, the rabbinic belief that parents must teach their children a useful trade, the affirmative Jewish attitude towards wealth. And then he notes the Gemara's respect for competition, at least in the case of chinuch, that we, right, that kinet sofrim tarba chachma, that Chazal said there's no limitation on competition amongst educators because competition will bring about excellence. So Chief Rabbi Sacks said, if you look at all these principles, it emerges that halacha is sort of more in that the capitalist direction. But there was, as I said, a third view, and that was Yovel. So what I want to do is analyze some of the approaches to Yovel over the years and watch how people try to use it to construct a uniquely Jewish economic model. So the first person to really try to do this in the modern period, in number seven was actually Herzl. Herzl in, and this is one of the funny things about it, is that you'll find extensive biblical analysis by totally secular thinkers. So Herzl in Altumland, or whatever, the old new land, claims as follows, right? He said, the Jubilee year, explained David, it's written as a dialogue, right, is not a new but an ancient institution set up by our teacher Moses. After seven times 7 years, that is to say in the 50th year, land which has been sold reverted back to its original owner without compensation. We indeed arrange it a bit differently. The land now reverts back to the new society. Moses in his day wished to distribute land so as to ensure the end of social justice. You will see that our methods serve the purpose nonetheless. The increase in land values accrue not to the individual owner, but to the public. So Herzl looked towards Yovel. But Herzl found in Yovel his source that Judaism was socialist. But this is a problem, because what he did is he made a slight tweak on the laws of Yovel that moved Yovel from being what we'll see in a moment is ostensibly a more capitalist principle to a socialist principle. Right? And that's as follows. Yovel tells you that every 50 years, property goes back to its original owner, right? So Yovel, while it's true you can't sell land in perpetuity, right? Yovel, by definition, respects private property to the right in two senses. One is that it allows you to sell land, or leased land, let's say, to the Yovel. And two is that when it reverts to individuals. Right, so even though you have a limitation on how long you can sell it for, still the Torah is forcing you to maintain your ancestral property. Right, Herzl tweaked it and said instead of giving it back to individuals, we'll give it to the government. Right, we'll give it to the new society. Right, thereby taking what is a principle established to protect private property or ancestral property, more particularly, and turning it into absolute socialism.
So does that mean like the idea of capital appreciation doesn't really exist? So like the price of something, the price you might pay for something for the course of 50 years, like the lease payment might increase, but the idea of a capital appreciation, does that mean it doesn't exist?
Sort of, right? Sort of. Right, not completely, because it gets a bit more complicated, but the land does go back, right?
Goes there's back, so, right, okay.
To me, though, with Yovel, it's a very interesting concept, because back when Yovel was originally, the concept of Yovel originally existed, the economy was very much a commodity agricultural economy. In today's day and age, if you were going to have Yovel, like, it wouldn't really impact anything, because Israel today is a high-tech...
So we're going to see. What we're going to see is that this model of Yovel... Yeah, so that's what we're going to see. Is that this... What I found fascinating about this, like, this is totally new to me, like, as I was going through this, is that Poskim have been very creative. Not just... Right now we're looking at secular thinkers, but in a moment we'll get to Poskim. Have been very creative in trying to figure out what would Yovel even look like in the modern world. But we haven't gotten there yet. So Herzl... saw in Yovel, or his tweak of Yovel, Jewish socialism. Jabotinsky, on the other hand, did not like this at all. So Jabotinsky wrote an extensive analysis of Yovel in number 8. Now this was written in Yiddish, so I'm just giving it to you in English. I don't read the Yiddish, and the Hebrew is no better of a translation than the English. So he wrote an article called The Jubilee, The Biblical Plan for Expanded Ownership. Now this is, again, even though Zev Jabotinsky was not religious at all, and you'll see in somewhere in this, he tells you that like he doesn't really care about Torah or about God. That's not why he's doing this. He is actually a very careful analyst of Torah law. This is how he writes. He writes, Introduction, the Biblical Economic Plan versus Socialism. So he says, Socialism is an attempt to prevent social ills. It is a plan for social order, which by its very existence will eliminate inequality. In capital ownership, once and for all. Socialism eliminates this problem by expropriating the means of mass production from private ownership once and for all. The biblical plan has nothing in common with this prophylactic scheme, which prevents from the beginning any possibility of social inequality, exploitation, economic competition. The Bible seeks to preserve economic liberty, but to reform it by certain limitations and antidotes. Right? So the first thing he notes is that what, at its core, is socialism about? Right? Socialism is about preventing inequality. But he said, Yovel, even though it forces, you know, it prevents permanent sale of land, doesn't do that, because the whole institution of Yovel allows for 50 years of people accruing wealth, and at the end just sort of makes you give back land. But the whole assumption, right, no one sold their ancestral land unless they were poor, which means there were poor people and there were rich people. There were rich people who could buy the land, and poor people who needed to sell their ancestral land. And the Torah doesn't try to stop that, right? So he said, even though this isn't totally free market, it's fundamentally different from socialism, because socialism, as he says, is prophylactic, right? Meaning it's preventative, right? It's a vaccine against inequality, as opposed to Yovel, which allows inequality, it just doesn't let it to get too extreme. Right, which means it doesn't have a problem. And then he explains the difference, right, in B. He pushes it, and he says, the main difference between the biblical revolution and socialist revolutions is that the latter are supposed to occur once and for all, while the Jubilee revolution should occur at regular intervals. According to plans based on the socialist ideal, a just distribution of land and measures of social justice in general will be set one day and admit no further changes. According to the biblical plan, economic life will preserve after the Jubilee full liberty for further changes. People will continue to make projects, scheme, struggle, and compete. Some will become rich, some will become poor. Life will keep the character of an arena in which it is possible to lose or win, show initiative, and fail or succeed. Right? Did Yovel, right, even though it's true that every 50 years we sort of reset the clock, said what is at the... Right, what's at the core of capitalism, right, without getting to how extreme it is that there is, the more work you put in, the more you can make, right? That there's actually a distinction. It's not presumed equality no matter what. You know, each according to his needs, each according to his needs, whatever, right? Each according to his means, each according to his needs, however the phrase goes. At least for 50 years, people can become rich. And the truth is, as we'll see, he doesn't make this point, though others do. Yovel only affects land, right? So just to take a very simple example, let's say at the beginning of a Yovel cycle, you bought property. And then on that property, you built a 50-story skyscraper, right? And then you rented out the property for the entire 49 years until the next Yovel. So you brought in, whatever, let's say you paid $1 million for the property, and you brought in over 50 years, $100 million in revenue. Now, without getting into what happens to the apartment building that's currently on that property, right? At the end of it, you return the land, right? You return the land to the original owner. But the reality is the guy now just has property, and you have $100 million in the bank with which a year after Yovel, you can now buy the land back, right? Release it for 49 years. You could go buy other property, right? You could have used that money to invest in other things, meaning it's very limited to ancestral property, but it doesn't equalize the market, meaning you've had the opportunity to build wealth in that, and that doesn't change in Yovel. So it's not in any way, shape, or form pure socialism. And then he continues, right? He says, what does the Torah do? It has two limitations, right? The economic liberty, we only have two limitations. He said the first limitation, or rather entire system of limitations, functions continuously. Work is prohibited one day a week, right? Shabbos. Right? He says the Torah isn't socialism, right? It's capitalism with limitations. What are the limitations? One is Shabbos, which has a economic component to it. Two is peah and other tzedakot. Right? One must leave the corner of his field and the gleanings of his vineyard for the poor. The tithe will be paid, being holy unto God. Translated into modern terminology, this means limiting and regulating the working hours. Right? So he sees in Shabbos proof that there's some limitation on employment. Right? There's some mandatory rest. And generally, all legislation for employee protection, all social security and progressive taxing. The other limitation, or rather antidote to economic liberalism, is the Jubilee. It is as if a huge axe sweeps once in a while, like a storm over the forest of humanity, and cuts down those tree tops which have grown above the average. Debts are canceled, the impoverished regain their property, the slave goes free, balance is restored, and the economic game starts over again until the next upheaval. One may ask whether the Jubilee system is better or worse than socialism, but let us shelve this question for a moment. At present, the important thing is to establish that Jubilee is the very antithesis of socialism. The concept of repeated economic upheavals is an attempt to correct the ills of economic liberalism, not to forestall them. Quite on the contrary, this concept is clearly based on the conviction that free economic competition is one of the most powerful motivations in life. Let people struggle, lose and win. It is only necessary to cushion the arena with soft grass so that whoever falls will not be too painfully injured. Right? So Jabotinsky, again, he's totally secular, but it's a very sharp analysis of the difference between pure capitalism or socialism and Yovel. And his argument is that Yovel is actually more capitalist than socialist, but the distinction being that socialism opposes inequality at all. Capitalism, obviously, doesn't care. Yovel says we want people to strive because socialism doesn't give people any motivation to work. We don't want that because we believe that there's an importance to motivating people to work. But we also think that too extreme of inequality is problematic. So what we do is we have this middle model, right? Yovel would just make sure that things don't get out of control, right? It's essentially minimal government intervention, right, on the periphery. And then he has this sort of sweeping statement at the end, right? He says, if I were a king, I would reform my kingdom on the basis of a Jubilee concept rather than socialism. Of course, first I would have to find wise counselors and charge them preparing a detailed plan on the basis of biblical indication. The ancient, inflexible, childish formulation cannot be carried out in our complex life, right? So you can tell, right? He's not a frum Jew. He doesn't like the Torah per se. He likes Yovel, but he doesn't like the Torah per se. But he wants to find some way of implementing it. I would assemble wise men, charge them with developing the biblical indication, translating into modern terminology. But I'm no king. On the contrary, I'm a child of that class whose very name is an object of scorn, the bourgeoisie. I believe not only the capitalist system is inherently stable, but that it contains the seeds of a certain social ideal. Ideal in its usual connotation, i.e. a vision worth dreaming of and fighting for. Nevertheless, I believe that a new Marx will arrive and write 3 volumes on its ideology. And maybe they will not call it Der Kapital, but the Jubilee. Right. So this was Jabotinsky's sort of vision. Now, Jabotinsky, like I said, was secular.
He's firmer than most people.
He is firmer than most people. Mm-hmm. But it didn't die with him. Right? Herzl and Jabotinsky were not, by any stretch of the imagination, the last thinkers who said that the Torah has something unique, which is not quite socialism and not quite capitalism, for economics. So I gave you here...
A second, sorry. You're like jumping, not you, but like the argument jumps between capitalism for socialism. Like I can understand how either one of those different philosophies can be implemented in, let's say, today's economy. I can't even imagine what Yovel does to... You can't even... It's
good. Totally so what? Off. So what would it mean...
Dual's law of values, everything.
Right? Everything. Interest would be charged at wildly different rates. Like,
yes.
The fact that debt forgiveness exists, it can't imagine.
Good. You think it's property value of X. Well, with Yovel, that property value is X minus 80%.
Correct. Correct, because it's only it's a lease.
Yeah.
Right? That's what it is. It's a lease. So what does it look like to implement it? So there have been a series of wild suggestions over the years. I gave you... So there's this... there's a fascinating professor. I've come across him before, named Errol Siegel. He is a professor at University of Ariel. Who's very into these things. So he wrote an excellent, excellent survey article on the history of Yovel and Zionist thought, and then for some reason wrote a English translation of it and put it for free on his website. I don't know why, but I gave it to you in 9. I just gave you a bunch. We don't have to read through them inside, but there have been crazy, crazy suggestions. So, for example, number 3, Rav Dov Rosen, who was, I don't know who he is, but he was a Jewish Orthodox rabbi and a socialist. Here is his suggestion, which is lunatic, but was a 100% inheritance tax. That was his solution, right? He said, right, what's the Yesod of Yovel? So he took a Herzl-esque approach, right? The Yesod of Yovel is that, you know, at some point you have to give your property back, not to the individual, but to the community. And he said, well, let's not do it every 50 years, let's do it once in a lifetime. There's no such thing as inheritance, it goes back to the state on death, right? Now this is obviously, right, suffers extremely from the principle, the Herzl problem, right? But worse, right? Because first of all, not only does it include everything, right? And does it go back not to the individual, but to the government, but it proves the opposite, right? Yovel is meant to strengthen ancestral property rights, right? Which is the opposite of 100% inheritance tax. I mean, right. Obviously, it's a mitzvah d'oraisa to have inheritance, right? You're not allowed to circumvent inheritance, right? It's a mitzvah to give it on, so that's a bit of a...
This seems just very circumventable in the sense that, like, hey, 100% inheritance tax, so fine, so I'm going to...
I'll do it.
I'm everything... in my kid's name.
Yeah. Correct, dude. That's what you do. And that's what everybody does anyway. Yes.
You get taxed.
Spend it all, so you tax it, fine.
Correct.
We'll figure it out.
So I gave you here in number 4, right, probably the most major implication in Israeli law, as I said, I already mentioned this one, is Kakal, is that most land in Israel, sorry, he says 93% of all lands in Israel is owned by the state. I don't know what the number is. I've heard 80, I've heard whatever. He says 93 here, is owned by the state. Originally, actually, it was a 49-year lease because it was actually meant to model Yovel. At some point, it became a 99-year lease. I'm not sure exactly. Right. At some point, they realized 49 was a problem, so they moved it to 99. But originally, it was actually 49 years. It was meant to be Yovel. There was a bit of machlok, as I gave you here. There was a professor, Yitzchak Chayutman, who suggested that it should apply to Palestinian groups and other groups who see themselves related to the land as well. Yoav Rubin suggested inheritance tax, just not 100%. But then, There were a bunch of poskim. Rav Yaakov Ariel writes this in one line, who said, you know what? I'm going to extrapolate a little what they said. And this is, you know, this was Noam's problem. It's very nice to say that Yovel shall apply in the modern time. Now, we should just make it clear. Halachically, Yovel does not apply nowadays. Right? The reason is because Gemara says Yovel only applies b'bias kulchem. When the majority of Jews live in Israel, Yovel applies. Now, that will happen ostensibly soon.
Isn't that very close?
So we're getting there, right? So then Shemitah will be Daraisa. Yovel might be Daraisa, but it hasn't yet happened, so we haven't had to deal with
but
it quite.
How do you deal with it? Nobody knows what the ancestral homeland even is.
Correct, and then you have to deal with Bezdin. But at the moment, it doesn't apply, right? When it will apply, what we'll do with Shemitah and Yovel and all that stuff is very complicated. But assuming it doesn't apply, one. And two, assuming that we want to try to find a way of making it meaningful in the modern world, Poskim, who take Torah seriously, decided that we need to think more broadly and say, okay, Yovel doesn't apply as is, but what could it mean? Right? What could the ethos of Yovel look like if we want to try, if not in a formal level, but at a spiritual level, to channel Yovel, what would that look like as a practical policy? So I gave you here, Rav Yaakov Ariel, who was a leading posek in the modern Orthodox, in the Dati Lumi world, he has a cryptic line. He just says that Yovel should apply to all means of production. But he doesn't explain what that means. Avram Sabag, who I don't know who that is, suggested it should apply to all state-owned companies, and the way he wants to do it is to divide all state-owned companies into shares. Right? And every citizen will have a share, which they can do with it whatever they want. The person who wrote most extensively on it, in a tshuva that I found fascinating, is Levin. Right? This is just an attempt. Sort of Elazar Malamud, who's one of these really sort of very prominent but also out-of-the-box thinkers in Israel, he was posed with the following shaila. Right, 3 years ago, this was all the rage in Israel. It's still a bit of an issue. Right, Israel had contracted to private companies to excavate in the Mediterranean looking for natural resources, and they found natural gas. So then a big dispute arose in Israel. Who should own the rights to the natural gas? Should it be owned by the private companies who excavated it, or should be owned by the state? There were two questions, right? One was a contractual question, which was what did they agree to, which no one could figure out. That went to the courts. Let's leave the contractual issue aside. That's classic Israel. No one quite knows what anybody agreed to. Fine. But the other question was fundamentally, right? Assuming there wasn't already a contractual agreement, who should own it? Sort of Malamud decided following... You'll see there's a lot of similarities to Jabotinsky, that he thought that you could learn from Yovel what we should do. And this is what he wrote. He writes, "Can we learn from the Torah what should be the fair arrangement, both morally and economically, in regards to the natural gas issue, which has recently been the focus of public debate?" So he notes, "Unlike the communist system, the Torah does not command us to divide profits equally between successful workers and those who are not. On the contrary, the Torah secures property rights of the individual over his possessions based on the position that a person is entitled to benefit from the fruits of his own efforts, talents, and God's blessings. Nevertheless, there's an important element of equality in the Torah expressed in the mitzvah of Yovel." So the integration of two ideas. It can be said that, indeed, both ideas, equality on the one hand and free will and free enterprise on the other, ought to receive mutual expression. On the one hand, all human beings were created in the image of God and are equal before the law and before all else. Lands, which are the means of production, should be divided equally. On the other hand, the most important expression of God's image in man is his ability to choose and initiate. If he works hard and utilizes his talents, he will profit. If he's lazy, he will lose. And on a spiritual level, if one fulfills the Torah mitzvah, he'll be blessed in the present world and receive good reward in the hereafter. But if he chooses to sin, he will not see blessing in this world and will be punished in the next. The significance of Yovel for our times. In the past, so now he tries to make the jump. He says, in the past, 90% of people made their living from agriculture. Land was the main means of production, right? So now he makes the first leap. He says, why was it land? Why did Yovel apply to land? Because land was, and this is the socialist jump, right? It's the means of production, right? So this is the Marx claim, right? And as a result, dividing equally forms a basis of equality for everyone. But today, land is no longer the primary means of production, and earning a livelihood is dependent on many factors. Nevertheless, we should seemingly learn from the mitzvah of Yovel two foundations. First, just as farmland was divided equally among all, similarly, we should divide other natural resources, which God created equally, including land for construction, water, oil, gas, beaches, radio waves, air, and the sun. Second, just as the Torah commanded dividing the means of production equally, likely we should attempt to provide an education for all young people that will procure for them as best as possible an equal opportunity to earn a living from their talents and diligence. With effective planning, these two elements can be mutually integrated by diverting the money received from the natural resources towards professional education programs for all. Right? So he makes a huge jump. He says, what is Yovel? Yovel means that people should have initial equal access to two things: means of production, and they should start an equal plane to be able to enter the workforce. Right? So from here he derives, what's the modern equivalent of land in the time of the Gemara? Natural resources, right, and education. Because the two things you need to get by in life, right, are some sort of capital, some stake in natural, in the means of production, and an education, which is the leveling field. Right? It doesn't assure that everyone will remain equal, but it gives everyone somewhere to start from, which is what land did in an agricultural society. So therefore, his proposal for, he calls it the proposal of Yovel for capitalists. Further, perhaps a further suggestion should be made that just as the Yovel, the fields returned to their original owners and slaves were released to their homes in a similar fashion, Torah scholars should conduct an in-depth examination of the structure of modern economy and consider whether it is appropriate for the Yovel year a certain percentage of the accumulated wealth be divided equally. For in addition to laws designed to prevent monopolies which harm free competition, stifle industry and trade, we should avoid creating overly large gaps between the extremely rich and the remainder of the population. This idea also includes a measure of justice because well-run public organizations allow the major capital list to become wealthy, and therefore maybe it is fitting that once in 50 years a portion of their accumulated wealth be once again distributed for education and public needs. This will not affect their quality of life. They will still have hundreds of millions of dollars, but it will grant a more important status to the value of equality without harming the individual responsibility of every person to earn a living. Right? So Malamud tries to come up with a very creative, modern interpretation of Yovel, which is land in a fundamentally agricultural society is the basic thing which allows you not to be as rich as everybody else, but to enter the workforce, right? It's the basic means of production. And Yovel, in addition to dividing up those things, prevents at the extremes a tremendous amount of economic inequality. And therefore, his modern interpretation is that natural resources should not be divided to individual straight, but should be divided specifically towards granting free education, which will give even the poor who can't normally afford education a starting point in the modern economy, plus to public other public needs, which are the modern equivalent of land. Right? So what you see is Rav Malamud trying to channel not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law of Yovel in a way that means something in a modern economy. Now, I gave you in 10 Errol Siegel's analysis, right? Originally, his summary. He also tries. Now, he notes, I'm not going to read it all in, but he notes problems with basically everything that's been said before. Right? So first he notes, right, you have to ask a few questions. One is, what is divided? So he notes, the minimalist approach is that it should apply only to land. The maximalist approach was like, you know, the people who said the 100% inheritance tax, right? That Yovel in the modern world should apply to everything. The medium approach is those like Rav Malamud to say it should, somewhere in the middle, right? Means of production or something like that. He notes, however, that from a Torah perspective, anything but the minimalist approach is really difficult. He said the maximalist approach is off the table because it only applies to land. But he said even the minimalist approach is off the table. Sorry, the medium approach is off the table. Because, and here he notes something important. Right, until now, what has everybody assumed? Right, everyone has assumed that Yovel is fundamentally about economic equality in some way, shape, or form. But he says it's not really true. The theology of Yovel is Kili Haaretz, right? It's a theological claim that God doesn't want the land to be sold forever because land is unique because God divided it amongst ancestral things. It's not about equality. It's about recognizing God owes the land per se, right? So therefore he says, what are you talking about? Right? All of this assumes that Yovel is fundamentally or primarily an economic model rather than a theological one. But if it's a theological one, it's not meant to be expanded. It applies to land in Israel that was divided in the original, right, in the original division, in which case you couldn't learn anything about means of production and things like that.
Is water never divided? Like,
no.
From a shot, like certain, like, I don't know, the way they do it now, like nautical miles from a nation that
no, like, it was just the land, right? It was just the inheritance, right? It's just the land of Israel. Then he notes that trying to figure out how much to divide is very complicated because the Gemara has a machlokas. When they originally divided the land, right? Even at the time of the Gemara, they were... Oh, sorry. Another thing that he notes... two other things he notes. Besides for the minimalist approach being supported by the theological approach, he notes something even more important. The Torah explicitly says that there's one type of property for which Yovel doesn't apply, and that is land in a walled city, meaning urban land, right? He says if Yovel was about equality, even in the time of the Gemara, land within cities was more expensive than fields, right? It was prime real estate. But the halacha is that anything that's in a walled city, you get 1 year chance to redeem it, and once you don't redeem it, it is permanent. It doesn't go back in Yovel. So how can you take a maximalist approach and say that Yovel is about equality if prime real estate was the only real estate in the country that was permanent? Right? That's counterintuitive. It doesn't make any sense. Right? You wouldn't say, well, you know, Manhattan and downtown Toronto, that land can be forever. But the land in Alberta, right, that has to be returned if you wanted equality, right? Because the mega real estate players who own land in the cities would be allowed to keep their land forever. It's only the people who have, like, farmland somewhere, right, that would have to return it, right? That doesn't make any sense if you're talking about equality. He also notes that all these previous things haven't understood that even the Gemara notes that even when land was divided equally, they knew that different real estate was worth different things, and therefore the Gemara has a machlokes. When they divided the land, so people who got land in the city, the land was more expensive. Let's say not walled city. So how did they deal with the fact that people got cheaper land? So the Gemara gives two options. Either they divided it by price. So if you got fields, you got a tremendous amount of fields, and if you got, you know, urban property, you got a parking spot, right? Or they divided it by money, right? That if you got the land in the city, you had to pay for it, right? So he notes that no one who's been raising anything has been bringing in this conversation, and no one's answering the more complicated question, which is, and this was Nitragi's question: what happens if there's been capital appreciation? Right, how do you deal with it? No one's dealing with it, but the Gemara dealt with it. Right, the Gemara already raised this problem: is that you can't just return it blindly. Right, there is a recognition of appreciation, and you can't just come in and swoop it in without taking into account the Gemara's considerations itself. So therefore, he says maybe a land value tax or something would be more true rather than a just taking property away. Then he has his unique approach. He says, who should get, once we figure out what Yovel should do, who do we give it to? So he uses the model of the 2.5 Shvatim, right? Where Moshe said, I'll only give you land if you fight for the Jews, right? Otherwise you won't get property. And therefore he says, you see that in the Torah, and it's only divided to Kol Yotzei Tzava, right? To people of military age. And therefore he says, however we decide Yovel should happen, it should be given to people who've done either the army or Shirut Leumi. Right, that's his sort of final twist on the Yovel model. And like I said, there's a million different models that you could come up with in the middle. I didn't even give you all of them that have been suggested even to now. But what's fascinating about it, without coming to a conclusion on it, is that what you see from all these different thinkers, right? You had the few thinkers who thought that Yovel was just an expression of socialism, But then you have all these thinkers who think that, no, the Torah has something unique to contribute to a philosophy of economics, which isn't quite socialist. It's more capitalist than socialist in the sense that it allows accumulation of wealth and it encourages free enterprise and even through the Yovel allows accumulation of wealth. But there's definitely a equalizing component that's part of it, right? Because the Torah may not endorse socialism, but it also does have some control, right? Some padding, which we know, right? Rules of tzedakah and the like, as Jabotinsky already noted, tell you that the Torah isn't laissez-faire. It does totally, right? Meaning it does institute a level, even if a minimal level, of social welfare into the economic system itself. They argue, as you can see, right, how what Yovel would mean channeled into a modern economy, whether it means including the lands of production, including education in it, or limiting it to land because land was actually unique. It wasn't just because of the means of production. But what I think is the sort of lesson to come out of it, right, even if you don't have a conclusion on it, right, besides for that, you know, I think the analysis is more compelling, that Yovel proves that the Torah is actually pro, at some level, many of the fundamental principles of capitalism, even if it has limitations, right? It has ethical limitations, which is not surprising. That's classic Torah, right? It puts ethical principles to tell you how you should run things. What everybody here, from Herzl to Jabotinsky to Yaakov Ariel, or Malamud and everybody in between, believed, and which is, I think, not normally spoken about, is that to be a Jewish state, you have to recognize Torah actually has something to say. No one knows what it is. No one knows what it is. But it has something to say about the most fundamental questions that plague humankind. Right? You know, and I gave this in Truas, right? You know, people said, well, what's the conclusion? Right? You know, meaning if it can go from left to, you know, from left to right, if you can say that Yovel supports socialism and capitalism, right? So doesn't it mean the Torah has nothing to say about it? But the truth is no. Meaning it's true. That's true in Shabbos and Kashrus and Nida and everything in between, right? When we learn Shabbos, the fact that one person says it's mutar lechatchila, the other person says it's asr midaraisa, right? That doesn't faze us, right? We don't think the Torah has nothing to say about Shabbos because we know the Torah has something to say about Shabbos, even if we don't know what it is, right? We don't know if opening a can is a chiv daraisa of bone or mutar lechatchila. We have no idea, right? So Moshe says one thing, Michal Zanisha is another.
I'm the Shabbos boy, my in-laws.
Okay, there you go, right? But it doesn't bother us, right? We know that the Torah has something to say.
That dirty looks the first time I've
heard that. But it doesn't bother us, right? We know that the Torah says something about Shabbos. It doesn't bother us that there's machlokas, right, from one extreme to the other. And it shouldn't by economics also. I mean, the one conviction that everybody here shared, even though they couldn't agree what it is that the major questions of human life, right? You know, when you go to a, you know, when you talk major questions of human life, people aren't just talking Shabbos kashrus. They're talking politics, right? And they're talking economics, right? Those are the questions that run societies, right? What everyone agrees here is that the Torah actually has something to say about that, right? And that, I think, alone is a fascinating thing, right? Is that you realize when everyone is fighting, and the same thing is true of democracy, right? When you see that all the founding fathers of America, of all things, are fighting tooth and nail and trying to figure out, well, is the Torah pro-monarchy, right? Or is it pro-democracy, right? Even though you could come to both conclusions, and classical Mefarshim have, it's machlokes in the Gemara itself. The point is the Torah speaks to it. I mean, the Torah has something to say about the major institutions that run states. And that's part of Zionist thought for sure, which is why the Zionists cared about it. But it's also just part of being a from Jew, is realizing that Torah is more expansive than Shabbos, Kashrus, Taras, and Mishpacha. It has something to say, and what you see is, like Jabotinsky, you can agree or disagree. But the fact is that he sat down with the mitzvah and the Torah and took it seriously enough to try to construct an economic model, and his conclusion was that the Torah actually has a third model that doesn't fit perfectly into the two models that are prevalent in the Western world, but it does have something profound to say about economics, right? And that alone is, I think, a very impressive thing to realize, right? And that the fact that person after person in the last 100 years have thought it worth it to ask the question, what does the Torah say about economics, right, reminds us that one of the things having a state has reminded the Jewish people is that Judaism isn't just meant to be parochial. The Torah doesn't only have things to say about classic religious questions. It has very serious things to say about economics and politics. And just like you can argue for forever on a complicated halachic shayla, you know, a Shabbos shayla, you can argue for forever and go into the sigyot and ask, well, when you get to the basis of it, what is the Torah saying about economics? And in this case, what they all thought is that Yovel is the key to it. They don't know what it means, right? But the Yovel is the key to it because they see that it's trying to do something that is unique, that's allowing for initiative and freedom of capitalism, but recognizes the need for controls, right, for either ethical, moral reasons or, as Segal points out, for theological reasons, right? Now, which of those it is has vast implications on whether you expand it beyond land, beyond Israel, etc., etc. But the very fact that they all believe it's worth looking towards the Torah to come up with a unique model should give us pause when we think about the question, what exactly is Judaism? What is it? What is it talking about? Right? And remember, it talks about much bigger questions than the ones we're used to thinking about. It deals with, again, the major questions in human life, right? That political philosophers, economic thinkers have thought about, and actually is something to add that's different than everybody else. So that's what I found cool about this whole sort of historical survey of it. By the end, I'm totally confused. Of which one it is. I do find at least parts of Segal's.
So that can pause the questions.
I don't think so. I mean,
what's,
you look at these,
your
right?
View of what you actually think the philosophy is behind it.
So I don't know, right? Meaning I tend to...
If you had to pick a side.
If I had to pick a side, I would say that I would apply it as minimal... I would say two things. My conviction is on the side that Yovel, on balance, pushes towards capitalism, right? Because the proofs being, A, it's limited to land, right? B, it excludes the most valuable land in cities, right? And... right, it doesn't. As Segal himself notes in his article, it's true that the primary source of wealth in the time of the Torah was land, but the Torah knew about money, right, and knew about livestock, right. Like the Torah went out of its way to not include other major sources of wealth in Yovel, so it's clearly not absolute. That's point one. Two is, I think Yovel at some level does say something about a level of control. Because it's true, the Torah is not purely laissez-faire. That's obvious, right? In a pure laissez-faire capitalist society, the way Adam Smith sort of imagines it, even though he's not pure either, but, you know, charity won't be part of the system of justice, but it will be part of society, right? Adam, right, he has a two-level system, right? I think we've talked about this briefly, right? But part of society is benevolence. It's just that benevolence isn't instituted into law. Right? The Torah doesn't do that because the Torah is more than just a legal system. It's also an ethical system. So obviously, right? Meaning any good, right? This is what people always point out, right? Republicans who are laissez-faire capitalists are still more likely to be charitable than Democrats, right? It's just that they don't think it should be part of law. But Torah doesn't work that way because the Torah is, right, both a legal system and an ethical system. So it's clear that the Torah, in the end of the day, is going to have some constraints on capitalism because... just like any good capitalist with a moral backbone thinks that there should be constraints on capitalism, maybe not legally, but ethically, right? And there should be some social welfare net. Again, government-run or not government-run, right? The Torah, obviously, is going to have it government-run because everything's under the auspices of halacha, right? So that's point two. Point three is, I'm convinced by Segal's basic point, is that to the extent that Yovel will be applied, it will be minimalist. Because because I disagree with most of this analysis, right? Most of the analysis which believe that Yovel is primarily about equality in some way, shape, or form, rather than about theology, right? Namely, Kili Haaretz, that Israel is unique. Right? It's not about land. It's that Israel's land is unique because it's God's, and God wants to emphasize to you that you aren't the true owner, right? I think pushes towards the minimalist approach. So how exactly it played out, I'm not sure. But those three things are my intuitions, right? That the Torah is more capitalist than socialist. That two, halacha, by virtue of the fact that it's an ethical system and not just a legal system, will include a level of social welfare because even if in America you would endorse that being, or Canada, you'd endorse that being external to law. In halacha, it'll obviously be internal, because internal, because halacha includes ethics in it. And point three is that, to the extent that I think you can apply Yovel, I would do it minimal. I think the minimalist model has the most to suggest it, because it's the only one that reflects what the Torah actually says, which is, it's about land in Israel because of Kili Ha'aretz. It's about ancestral property in Israel, not about land per se or the means of production. How it would play out, I don't know. Those are my intuitions, right? It's the most minimalist of the approaches. I find them the most compelling. If you want to look at the whole article, you can look online, Errol Siegel's article, and you'll see there's a million. I gave you a few links for different articles throughout. I gave you number one in another one in five. Those are my intuitions. But I do think it's another proof that the Torah is more capitalist than socialist, because once you go through the theories, the more compelling ones are the ones that notice not that there is Yovel, which limits property, but that Yovel itself is so limited as to emphasize by its silence the fact that we encourage productivity, right? Capitalist productivity in things which aren't ancestral land, which is the majority of, right, majority of property. So that's my intuition.
This is neither here nor there, I guess, but it's actually, I find it's hard to have the debate within the framework of capitalist for socialist, because a big flaw in socialism is, who are you to decide what's best for me? But this is word of God.
Correct.
So in theory, this would set like the laws of physics of the economy, whereas like that aspect of socialism wouldn't exist.
Right. And no, I agree. And that's why I'm saying, that's what I agree with Segal on. That one of the reasons I would go minimalist is because the maximalist thinkers assume that the reason Yovel teaches you broad things about the economy is because it's about equality. But the Torah says that Yovel is about Kili Ha'aretz.
Right.
It's not about equality.
Right.
It's that in Israel, specifically, God wanted everyone to have ancestral property, and therefore he didn't want it to be forever, and therefore he said, it's my land, I'm not letting you do it. Which tells you that theology isn't primarily about equality. Secondarily, it has equality elements which teach us something about the economy, right? But primarily it's not. It's about theology. It's not about equality. And that does change things, right? And that's why where I think Jabotinsky fails, right? Jabotinsky says, I don't care about the Torah, right? I like Yovel, but I don't really care about the Torah. But the point is, you can't divorce them. The fact that the Torah frames it theologically tells you that it doesn't, if it weren't for the fact that it was Israel, it might not have this at all. It might be laissez-faire capitalism. It's just that it's Israel, and in Israel, there's also a theological component.
Right.
But anyways, at any rate, like I said, I found this sugya fascinating. That's what I did on Shavuos night, to keep people awake and myself awake. But it's it's one of those things I didn't know anything about until I sat down to research it. So, okay.